sacrifices of certain faithful men known by many names down through the centuries have been craftily hidden from you by the desolate Illuminati. These men willingly died defending the religious liberty of conscience many of you enjoy today. These men did not at any time bow the knee to Roman Catholic dogma or partake in the doctrinal compromise of any other religious order, though their defiance cost them dearly. These men would go on to fight a revolutionary war, and their unshakable faith and unconcluded biblical principles led to the founding of the greatest experiment ever, the nation that would produce the greatest revival and awakening of biblical truth of all time. Who were these men who would have no king but Jesus Christ, who were the true founders of the United States of America? They have been called Waldensians, Donatists, Anabaptists, and most recently, Baptists. This is the Baptist Battle.
All right, Pastor Jason Cooley here for the Baptist Battle for Liberty, and I'm here with Brother Gerald Finney. And I'm glad to have Brother Finney here with me today here as we're going to go over some things here. It's called The Tale of Two Johns. And I want to talk to you about John Calvin's Geneva versus John Clark and Roger Williams, Rhode Island. The two governments were way different, vastly different. And one was for liberty and the other one was for tyranny and under the guise of Christianity. And it's really a tale of the difference between a church state, and separation of church and state. You know, we hear a lot, actually, Brother Finney, we hear a lot about how there's no such thing as separation of church and state. I mean, every conference I've ever been to or people that I've heard talk about it, they always say that for the most part. Most of them, they say, well, there's no such thing as separation of church and state. And what we find is that there's really an ignorance when it comes to that subject, because there's a part of history that has not been told to this present age and this present time, and even for the last 100 years, I would say, that history has been lost. And that is the history of Rhode Island. That is the history of men like John Clark and Roger Williams and Obadiah Holmes, men like that. And their history has not been told. And when you don't tell the proper history of the First Amendment, which Brother Finney's book, A Trail of Blood of the Martyrs of Jesus Christ, if you see that, what you find in here is the true history of the First Amendment. We talk about it. You talk about it in detail in your book here. And the reason, Brother Finney, could you tell me the reason you wrote this book?
Well, I got saved in the early 80s, became very active politically as a Christian, and I began to hear separation of church and state is not found in the Constitution. And of course, I looked at the First Amendment. Those terms are not there, and so I was very busy. I was working. I was going to church, made all the meetings and so forth. But I began to try to find out the history of the First Amendment. The Lord gave me a job to do, more or less, like Hezekiah. The Lord gave Hezekiah a job. And the job he gave me is, I want you to find out about how we got our First Amendment. So I went to Christian Revisionism. This was the first book, one of the first books, The Light and the Glory, Christian Revisionism. I read books by David Barden, Roger Federer, all the books that were being recommended by the Christian media and by churches and Christians that were coming down through the pike. Mm-hmm. And I believed those books. But none of them told me how we got our First Amendment. They would tell me about the Pilgrims and the Puritans.
Right, and the Puritans.
And the Anglicans arriving in Jamestown in 1607, right. The Pilgrims in 1620, the Puritans in 1629. And would tell me that because of them, they came here for religious liberty, we got our First Amendment. But they didn't tell me any of the history to speak of between the colonial, that initial colonial period, and almost 200 years later when the Constitution and the First Amendment was adopted.
So what's taken, what happened is that there's a great disconnect there. There's like a gap between the Puritans coming over, what took place to lead to our First Amendment. All we hear about is, well, there were these men, and they were pilgrims, they were Puritans, and they came over, and the Puritans came over, and they wanted religious liberty, so did the pilgrims, they came over, and they founded, you know, Massachusetts, Plymouth Rock, all those other things we talk about, the compacts that were made there, the Mayflower Compact is talked about, all those things are talked about. Then all of a sudden, boom, we speed ahead to the Bill of Rights and, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Madison and those other men. And like, along the way, wait a minute, now something's missing here. And what's missing is part of the history we are going to give you today. Now, we will be doing further Baptist Battle for Liberties to study this and to kind of, and I fully intend by the grace of God to cover separately men like Roger Williams, men like John Clark, men like Isaac Backus, Obadiah Holmes, those men that nobody talks about, and how we got our First Amendment. Now, this book covers it, but there's more details. I mean, a lot could be said. There's more. But he leaves, Brother Finney has all the references, and we're going to talk, we'll probably do a separate show also about talking about your book in general. We'll be using it a lot today, though, later on in the second hour of this, we'll be using it a lot. But I think it's important because here's one thing that we hear. We hear this. We hear that, well, John Calvin and the Reformation had a lot to do with the founding of America and the Bill of Rights. The Reformation, all these other things. Well, you know, and there's partly some truth to that, okay, in some ways. It certainly made it easier in some ways for there to be a First Amendment, for there to be a Bill of Rights, for there to be those things in some ways. However, what's not talked about is Calvin is given credit for, you know, for religious liberty, things like that, but that's not true. It's certainly not true. And what I want to show you this first hour is Calvin's Geneva. I want to show you how what happens when you mix, when you combine the church and the state together. I want to show you what happens. Now, to sum it up, tyranny. Now, let me say this to you. We are not doing this. We are not debating here today the doctrines of grace. We are not debating Calvin and its the doctrine of the soul, salvation. We're not doing that, okay? That's not what we're here to do. We're not here to talk about that today, okay? It's not about election or predestination or anything like that. We're not. That's not what this is about. What this is going to be a true and factual history of things that went on when Calvin, a pastor, ran and controlled Geneva. And what happened? So, and then we're going to compare when two Baptists, Roger Williams and John Clark, founded Rhode Island. And we're going to show the differences in government of the two. One was based on liberty. The other was based on a church state. So before we get into that, I just wanted to say that because I'm not here to you know, dump on Calvin or Calvinists or anything like that. That's not the point. The point is an honest truth, the honest truth of what took place. So, and there are many sources. Now, I'm going to put up those sources. There's going to be a page in the back of this book. This is one book I'm using called The Other Side of Calvinism. Now, I'm not using it for its doctrine of doctrines of grace or that, just the historical references in Geneva. There's also others, okay, that we're going to use. However, in the back here, there's going to be pages of references, and I'm going to have that put on the screen, okay, for you to be able to see all the references that we have so you can study these out yourself. I want you to check up on us. That's fine. I'm not trying to hide anything, and I'm not trying to pull one over on you. You're going to have the references to the books that all this information was taken from. It'll be behind us, and you'll be able to see it. Okay, and you'll be able to say, okay, well, let me go study that source. Let me go to that resource. Let me check that out to make sure that's valid and that's what was said. And by doing that, you'll be able to study it out yourself, and you'll know that this is what happened in Calvin's Geneva. And anyway, so we're going to get started here with that, and I'm going to read you some things here from that. And, you know, to set it up, Calvin and Geneva is an interesting story in itself, because Calvin went to Geneva the first time. Didn't work out for him. They kind of pushed him out, but then Geneva was set up for Calvin, and he came back, and when he came back, it wasn't good. What was formed out of that wasn't good at all. And I'm going to read some of that to you here right now, quite a bit of it, and then we'll comment. Brother Finney and I will comment on some of this. Let me just read some of this here. The evils of a united church and state, Catholic or Protestant, were not yet recognized. Consequently, a set of severe regulations were introduced even before Calvin arrived in the city. So they already wanted to set up a church state before Calvin got there, and Calvin was like the perfect leader to set that up, because Calvin had his own ideas and he was ready to go. Remember, those men, those sons of the Reformation, came from Roman Catholicism, and they didn't like the Pope, but they were sure fond of a church state control. So he says here, there were laws governing dress, music, games, church attendance, dancing, blasphemy, and oaths. And again, I'll put the references up there for you later, and you'll see those. They'll be behind us here. Education became free but compulsory. One citizen who refused to attend sermons was in prison, forced to go hear sermons, and finally banished from the city. By the way, there were 20,000 people in Geneva. When I read you the statistics of what took place there, you're going to be a little shocked. But this is what goes on when you mix the church and the state. When you combine those two together, it's very dangerous. Somebody's going to die. Naturally, there were many residents of Geneva who rebelled against the strict system of discipline. It was into this unstable environment that Calvin entered in 1536. But rather than separating the church from the state, Calvin used the power of the state to enforce his system of discipline. A hairdresser was imprisoned for 2 days for arranging a bride's hair in an unseemly manner. Think about that. So you do the hair wrong, and you get arrested for it, thrown into jail for it. Two Anabaptists were banished from the city on account of their theological views. See, we growing up in America, we don't even understand the concept of religious persecution. We grow up into a time of the First Amendment where we have flourished under that and for 200 years, and we don't know and understand, Brother Finney, what it's like to be in a place where you don't have that liberty. You know, we're on the other side of that. So for us to fathom that is just like we can hardly even understand that. Penalties were assessed for making a noise or laughing during church. How about that? I'm going to tell you what. Penalties are fines. Brother, we make a lot of money in our church off of that. I'm telling you.
Amen.
To noisy people out there.
For a while.
For a while. That's right. Yeah, exactly. Only work for a little while, right? A gambler was publicly punished. Many of the leaders of the opposition to Calvin were among those who at first supported the reform efforts. One man said it this way. Philip Schaff said this. Schaff maintains the inevitability of Calvin's return trip. Calvin was foreordained for Geneva and Geneva for Calvin. Both have made their calling and election sure, he said. We are told by Calvinists that Calvin envisioned a model Christian community based on Bible and patterned after the early church. Well, the early church was persecuted. The early church was not in control of the state. The early church flourished during times of persecution, right? They weren't a part of any church-state control.
And never persecuted.
No, and they never persecuted anyone. This has been variously termed a theocracy, a bibliocracy, a Christocracy. Now, Brother Finney, do you know anything about those terms there? A theocracy, let's say. What does it mean to have a theocracy?
Well, a theocracy is a combination of religion and state. Islam has a theocracy, promotes a theocracy. The other terms you mentioned, I looked at those to give a really thorough understanding of them, like bibliocracy.
Yep.
That's a term used by Protestant theologians, and it involves the use of Old Testament principles for the New Testament church.
Yep.
There's been a lot of scholarly works done on all three of those terms, but
you can look those up. The point basically is that they are going to govern. Am I right by saying this, Brother Finney, that they mean that they are going to govern by both tables of the law, the first and the second table? That means they are going to force a man's conscience, right? They're going to force him to submit to God and to the church-state model in matters pertaining to the conscience of a man and his worship to God.
That's correct, and the terms are really misleading, because if you do things the Bible way, the New Testament way, you don't have union of church and state.
Right.
And the same as to Christocracy.
Right.
Christ did not teach union of church and state for
Absolutely
the church.
Absolutely not.
And so forth. Clerocracy, I have an idea. I didn't really study that out, but I have an idea that means rule by the clergy. And, of course...
And Calvin did that.
Of both, you know, state and the church.
Right.
And, of course, the Bible, the New Testament principles are directly contrary to all of those.
Yep, amen. Well, and that's what was going on in Geneva. Calvin's first order of business was to submit to the city council his ecclesiastical ordinances. Okay, so are you catching this? To the city council, the government that governed Geneva, he turned in his ecclesiastical ordinances. These ordinances, which were adopted on November 20th, 1541, regulated the observance of baptism and communion and established the four church offices of pastor, doctors, elders, and deacons, corresponding to doctrine, education, discipline, and social welfare. So he presented these to the city. So the merging of church and state took place there, and Calvin had set up a theocracy. He was setting up where the Old Testament law governed the people.
Can I add something to that?
Yep, absolutely.
Of course, there's only been one theocracy, and that was the nation Israel. God ordained that. This is a substitute. It's a counterfeit.
That's right. It was, and it didn't work, and it never does work. It can't work. The elders were chosen by the magistracy, and together with the ministers formed a consistory to regulate discipline. Do you understand that? The magistrates of Geneva, the rulers of Geneva, chose the elders. They chose the ministers. They chose the preachers. So you have a church-state situation where the state is choosing the preachers and the pastors and the overseers and the doctors of the church, which is basically a teacher, a doctor. This is where you have the church state. This is where it mixes, and this is where you have a lot of problems. And what would happen is persecution. That's what comes in. It always does. After establishing ecclesiastical law, Calvin was called upon to codify the civil legislation. What does that word mean, brother, to codify?
To make into law.
Okay. So Calvin was in charge to codify the civil government, the civil legislation. Calvin did that. Now, why is that important to you and I? Well, what that means is that basically a lot of times you'll hear people say, well, Calvin wasn't in charge of what went on in Geneva. Calvin, wait a minute, Calvin codified the laws. So whatever went on in Geneva, by the law, that was Calvin's doing. Do you see how that mixture? See, some of us don't understand it because we've never been persecuted by that. You've never had anybody kick your door in ever and tell you that your hair is too long, your hair is too short, you didn't take communion, you didn't show up, you didn't do this, you didn't have your baby baptized. You've never had that happen before. You didn't have people spying on you. Calvin instituted see something, say something. I really firmly believe that Calvin ran a police state. And I'm going to prove that to you here as we continue on. But it's important for you to understand that not only the ecclesiastical laws, but the civil legislation he did. Does that sound like liberty? It all sounds good unless you disagree with Calvin. If you followed the Bible and disagreed with Calvin, guess what happens? The sword comes after you. That's where the danger comes in. And it did come in. His salary for preaching Calvin's was not paid out of the church collection, but from the city treasury. That's an important point.
Like in New England.
Like in New England, absolutely. And we're going to get to New England. Thus, from the very beginning of his ministry in Geneva, Calvin was intimately involved with both church and state. He counted among the duties of civil government. Now listen, this is what Calvin believed. This is the difference in the first table of the law, which is obedience to God, and the second table of the law. Brother Vinny, are you going to explain that in the next hour?
Why don't you explain it now
so we understand? Because people hear the first table, the second, they might not understand what we mean. So go ahead and explain that.
The first table, the first four commandments have to do with our relationship with God. The second table, the last six commandments, have to do with our relationship with our fellow man. And of course, civil government has a legitimate purpose in dealing with certain areas of our relationships with our fellow man. And that's a deep subject, but God ordained civil government and gave civil government authority over certain crimes. And yet, under Calvin, and as we will see in New England, the colonies, all 10 of the tables plus a significant portion of the Levitical law was enforced by the civil government.
Absolutely.
Working with the church.
So they did it. What they were enforcing is Old Testament Levitical law upon the citizens of Geneva. So that means the children, that means everyone. Now, you're going to pay attention very closely because you're going to see this, and you're going to see what happened as a result of this. If you think you can enforce Old Testament law from the government upon people, it's going to get ugly.
Can I add something to that, Pastor?
What's that?
Can I add one thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
And, of course, the law was not given to Gentile nations.
No.
And all nations except Israel are Gentile.
Yep.
The law applied to Israel. And again, that's another deep subject, but that's a distinction that needs to be made.
Right. And by the way, the old Baptists understood that as well, but we'll get to that in the next hour. All right. So Calvin counted among his duties of civil government, he said this, to cherish and protect the outward worship of God. Well, that's not... Listen, my congressman, that's not his duty. You understand that? That's not his duty. My congressman's duty is not to do that. The President of the United States' duty is not to... is to cherish and protect the outward worship of God. Or to defend sound doctrine of piety. What if I don't agree with his doctrine that he believes? So he tramples on my soul liberty and uses the power of the state and the sword to enforce his beliefs upon me. You see how dangerous this gets? Not yet, but you'll figure it out. And the position of the church, to adjust our life to the society of men, to form our social behavior to civil righteousness, to reconcile us with one another, and to promote general peace and tranquility. He said this, the civil government also prevents idolatry, sacrilege against God's name, blasphemies against his truth, and other public offenses against religion. Does that sound like liberty or tyranny? Because what if I don't agree with it? What if I believe he's wrong? Yet Botner still insists that the Reformed soon came to demand complete separation between church and state. And of Calvin, he incredibly adds, Calvin was the first of the Reformers to demand complete separation between church and state. Now stop, because I have to disagree with that. Because everything that I have read about Calvin and everything that he has said and everything that he has done would tell me that that is not the case. That is not the truth. Calvin did not do that. Calvin enforced the first table of the law and the second table of the law, which means that he did not give man a choice.
And I might add, that those methods and techniques have always accompanied the proponents of union of church and state.
Yep.
We'll see it in the colonies. All the way up till this very present day, they will hide true facts and just give you false conclusions.
Yes, absolutely. And here's the other thing about these reformers. Did Ulrich Zwingli believe in separation of church and state, complete separation of church and state, when he drowned the Anabaptists who disagreed with, who stood up for believers' baptism? Did Luther, when he said that those princes should go after those Anabaptists? Did Calvin, when he did some of these things that I'm going to show you and I've already talked about? It cannot be said that these reformers believed in separation of church and state. They did not. They may have believed that the state should not govern the church, but they certainly, Brother Finney, believed that the church should govern the state. They certainly believe that. It's just a reversal. Okay. Let's see here. Here's another thing. The rules and regulations introduced in Geneva during Calvin's ministry left no area of life untouched. This is why Calvin has frequently been labeled the Genevan dictator, who would tolerate in Geneva the opinions of only one person, his own. Besides the usual laws against dancing, profanity, gambling, and immodesty, listen to this, because you guys are in trouble here. The number of dishes eaten at a meal was regulated. Garrett's done. If this is Geneva, he's done. Attendance at public worship was made mandatory, and watchmen were directed to see that people went to the church. Went to church. Okay, stop. So what does that mean? When I say watchmen were directed to see that people went to church, see something, say something. They spied on you. And if you didn't go to church, they reported you to the SS. I mean, to Calvin. What else can you say? That doesn't sound like liberty. Does that sound like liberty? Not at all. Press censorship was instituted, and books judged to be heretical or immoral were banned. By the way, again, I'm going to give you all the references to these, so you have them. I can't read them all off because it'll take hours to do that. I'll have them in the background there. You can see them. You'll be able to check every reference. Interest on loans was capped at 5%. The naming of children was regulated. Naming a child after a Catholic saint was a penal offense. If you named a child after a Catholic saint, you were in trouble. Now, during an outbreak of the plague in 1545, over 20 persons were burnt alive for witchcraft. And Calvin himself was involved in the prosecutions. Okay, so all somebody had to do was say, you were a witch, I got this plague from you, and they're going to burn you at the stake. We heard about some of those Salem witch trials, right? Wonder where they got those from. We'll get to that. We'll keep going. Listen, even if one was a witch, in the New Testament, we are told to love our enemies and to pray for them, not and to convince them with the scriptures. Did Paul burn Simon the sorcerer? Did Peter kill Simon the sorcerer? No, he didn't. He said, I perceive that thou art in the gall of bitterness and the bond of iniquity. Get a match. Let's roast him. No, that's not in there. That's not in there, is it?
Have to go to the Old Testament.
But they had to go to the Old Testament to try to do that. Why didn't Peter burn him at the stake? If they were modeling Geneva after the early church, then they would pray for their enemies. They would love them and pray for them. and mightily convinced them with the scriptures. Because what was the revival that took place when they turned in? Is that Acts chapter 19? Amen? When they turned in all their books, right? And they burnt all their curious arts, their books. They burnt them all. They didn't burn the witches. The witches got saved and burnt their books. That's revival. That didn't happen under tyranny from a church state.
They voluntarily burned their own books.
Yes.
Nobody else's books.
Right. Do you see the difference? One is the power of the gospel. The other is the power of the sword to try to enforce the first table of the law, and somebody's going to die. I guarantee you those witches ain't going to get saved. They're in hell because those men burnt them. It didn't make them want to get saved. All right. And Calvin himself was involved in the prosecutions. From 1542 to 1546, 58 people were executed and 76 exiled from Geneva. Torture was freely used to extract confessions. The Calvinist John McNeill admits that in Calvin's latter years and under his influence, the laws of Geneva became more detailed and more stringent. Calvin was involved in every conceivable aspect of city life. Safety regulations to protect children. Laws against recruiting mercenaries. They probably wanted them so they could protect them. Being burnt. New inventions. He was in control of the patents, it looks like. The introduction of cloth manufacturing and even dentistry. He was consulted not only on all important state affairs, but on the supervision of the markets and assistance for the poor. Sounds like communism, right? Calvin was especially severe with incorrigible adulterers. He favored the death penalty. So if you were an adulterer, it's going to put you to death. Now, by the way, Jesus didn't tell the woman that was caught in adultery, did he? Did he say, burn her? He said, burn her, didn't he? So he said, hey, give me a match. Let's cook her. Did he say that? No. So do we model after Jesus Christ or the law of Moses? Did not Christ come? Was not the law a shadow of things to come? But Christ is the substance. Amen. Amen. That doesn't sound like a whole lot of grace to me. Not at all. Those guilty of fornication or adultery were fined and imprisoned. They were fined and imprisoned. Nevertheless, these laws did not stamp out adultery, for Calvin's own sister-in-law and stepdaughter were found guilty. Calvin's theory of a theocracy is professed to be based on the Holy Scriptures, but as Schaff astutely observes, he says this, "It is impossible to deny that this kind of legislation savors more of the austerity of old heathen Rome and the Levitical Code than of the gospel of Christ, and that the actual exercise of discipline was often petty, pedantic, and unnecessarily severe." This is church state, folks. This is what, and I'm telling you, you say, why is that important today? Because you have some dominionists that are running, that are trying to run this government, and they are trying to push that church state today. That same reform theology that wants to run the government wants to enforce that. See, I want to read to you here before I get to that. I think I'll read this part. I've got another note here. Calvin's, the initial accusatory complaint. Oh, we're going to start this with is it Servetus? Is that how you say his name? Servetus. Okay, I think that's right too, but I think you'll know who we're talking about when we get into him. But let's take, for instance, another man. There was a man that left a note behind the pulpit. Now, that was a very dangerous thing in Geneva to leave a note behind the pulpit. If you didn't like something, you left a note behind the pulpit for Calvin, you could lose your head, literally. So let that be a lesson to you, and be careful what note you leave behind the pulpit. No, I'm just kidding. It is not surprising that there was much opposition to Calvin among the residents of Geneva. Many who opposed Calvin during his first stay in the city were as equally antagonistic toward him when he returned. In 1547, a threatening letter was found on Calvin's pulpit. This is what the man said. "Gross hypocrite, thou and thy companions will gain little by your pains. If you do not save yourself by flight, nobody shall prevent your overthrow, and you will curse the hour when you left your monkery." Jacques Gruet, a known opponent of Calvin, was arrested for the deed. A search of his house uncovered some writings critical of scriptures and of Calvin. Among the writings was a plea addressed to the magistrates of Geneva. Now, here's this man's plea. I think he has a valid point in this plea. Here's what he said. "Everyone who maliciously and voluntarily hurts another deserves to be punished." I agree. "But suppose I am a man who wants to eat his meals as he pleases." It's like, maybe I don't want Calvin telling me how many plates I can have at dinner. Brother Garrett, he liked an extra helping of lasagna. Huh? He liked that extra helping of lasagna. He liked another piece of cake, Brother Zach. Even if it was his fourth or fifth one, he liked it.
Have another.
Even if he ate the last one so his pastor couldn't have a piece. He liked it. He said, "That's none of your business." I think he's right, don't you?
I think so.
He says, "Suppose I am a man who wants to eat his meals as he pleases. What affairs is that of others? Or if I want to dance." Now, I don't dance, because I'm a Baptist and Baptists don't dance. Right? But hey, he says, "Or have a good time. What has that to do with the law?" Nothing. Well, they found that letter, and they got mad. So, what happened? Let's say he said, well, let's say it this way. I bet you think Calvin said, "Well, you're going to hell. I disagree with you, but I'll pray for your soul anyway. But I think you're going to go to hell because you're a wicked sinner, and you love your sin, and you love cake too much." That's what he said to him, right? Wrong. After a month of torture, Gruet confessed and was sentenced to death. "You have outrageously offended and blasphemed against God and his holy word. You have conspired against the government. You have threatened God's servants and guilty of treason. Merit capital punishment." He was beheaded on July 26, 1547, with Calvin consenting to his death. Several years later, a heretical book of Gruet's was discovered and publicly burnt on Calvin's advice in front of Gruet's house. Well, that strikingly sounds Catholic to me. Where would he have got that idea, Brother Finney, to burn a man's books in front of his home? Sounds like from the Mother Rome. There was also some opposition in Geneva to Calvin's doctrine of predestination. In 1551, a medical doctor named Jerome Balsic got into that. He questioned Calvin's doctrine, and you didn't question Calvin's doctrine, and he got in trouble for that. Calvin appealed to the city council, and they ruled in his favor, declaring that Calvin's Book of the Institutes was a good and godly composition, that its doctrine was godly doctrine, that he was esteemed as a good and true minister of this city, and that thenceforth no one should dare to speak against this book and its doctrine. Now, whether you believe predestination, election, whatever, whether you believe that or not, or sovereign grace of God, whether you believe, that's not the point. The point is, I don't have the right, according to the New Testament, according to the Scriptures, I do not have the right to kill you because you disagree with me. I don't have the right to tread upon your conscience and force you to try to believe something with the power of the sword, or else I kill you because you disagree with me. That is not faith, that is tyranny. In fact, that is what the Jews did to Christ. Really? They persecuted him. Why? Because he said he was the Son of God. Right? Making himself equal to God. Well, they had a theological disagreement with him, and they put him to death. Amen. So what does Calvin do? Acts like the persecutors and puts the man, well, I don't know about this man, but put other men to death. Like the man that said that he wanted to dance and eat three plates of food. So there were doctrines and everything else that they fought about. Not everyone, of course, was opposed to Calvin. He certainly had his admirers. John Knox, the Scottish reformer, admired him. He said that when he spent several years in Geneva and termed it the most perfect school of Christ that ever was in the earth since the days of the apostles. Wow. So basically, and Calvin had a similar doctrine to Roman Catholicism in the sense of the church and the state. His doctrine wasn't much different. So we are told that Calvin was willing to break sharply with tradition where it was contrary to the word of God. Now that's what some of the historians say. Oh, Calvin, he would break with the tradition of the day if it meant following the word of God. Well, one man said, so whatever the customs, tradition, and prejudices of this age, Calvin, because of his profound reverence for the authority of the scriptures, he was an iconoclast. He wouldn't have done that. He was a trendsetter. You know, he wouldn't have done that. He would have went with the truth. Well, but such is not the case, because for Calvin, recognizing the errors of papal rulers, admonished Protestant rulers to emulate them. Here's what he said. Seeing that the defenders of the papacy are so bitter and bold in behalf of their superstitions that in their atrocious fury they shed the blood of the innocent, it should shame Christian magistrates that in the protection of certain truth they're entirely destitute of spirit. What was he saying? They don't have the guts, the spiritual fortitude to put these heretics to death for their blasphemies and their heresy. That doesn't sound very good. I guarantee you, you and I could not live in Geneva and keep our head at that time. We would not have stayed alive in Geneva. I know I wouldn't have. I'd have been getting out of there. Anyway, so the historian A.H. Newman said this. He said, Calvin virtually made every sin a crime, and so did not hesitate to make use of the civil power for the execution of church discipline. So here's what, this is how they produced discipline was done through the sword. Using the sword of the state, the power of the state, they disciplined their members and the city, the citizens. Calvin's view of the subordination of the civil power to the ecclesiastical does not appear to be radically different from the papal. And although Calvin's actions are repeatedly dismissed because of the spirit of his age, this is one of the arguments that comes up. They say, well, the spirit of the age. That's why Calvin killed these people. Well, Calvin wasn't the only one around. There were others around. How about the Anabaptists, against whom Calvin wrote? Against the Anabaptists in 1544. Certainly, the Anabaptists did not believe in persecuting their opponents. They didn't persecute anybody for their faith. The historian George Fisher correctly sums up the matter. No historical student needs to be told what an incalculable amount of evil has been wrought by Catholics and by Protestants from a mistaken belief in the perpetual validity of the Mosaic civil legislation, and from a confounding of the spirit of the old dispensation with that of the new. It is even acknowledged by Calvinists that the greater fruitage of Calvin's ideas elsewhere than in Geneva is due to the fact that in other areas they were not subjected to implementation by the civil state to the same degree as was true in Geneva. What does that mean? It means that nowhere else they didn't have the authority and the ability to be able to put people to death. Otherwise, they would have done the same as Calvin did. But it went worse in Geneva because Calvin had the authority of the state to enforce what he believed. Sounds like Sharia law, right?
Yep.
Sounds like the Spanish Inquisition, right? Sounds like Roman Catholicism concerning the government. Same thing. Now, we're going to move on with Calvin here to Servetus. And I want to move on and explain what happened with Servetus a little bit here in Geneva. So you understand what took place. Who is this man Servetus? Well, he was a heretic. I'm not making any bones about it. He was a heretic. But you know what? We don't run around. The practice should not be for Bible believers to run around and put heretics to death. So many people try to explain away that and say, well, Calvin didn't have anything to do with Servetus being put to death. It was this and blah, blah, blah. Well, his private writings and other things prove differently. Calvin did, and he admitted that he did. So I want to read you some things. Warfield, Benjamin Warfield, an historian and a theologian, insists that Calvin possessed little influence in the tribunal which condemned and executed Servetus. Henry Cole, the translator of two of Calvin's theological treaties, maintains that Calvin is falsely reported to have been the prominent advisor to the death of Servetus. Philip Hughes argues that Servetus was not burnt by Calvin, who had no authority to pronounce or even to vote for any such sentence. Michael Servetus was born in 1509 in Spain. He was educated at the University of Saragossa and later studied law at the University of Toulouse. He was a heretic. And Calvin did not like him. He was like a thorn in Calvin's side. And he kind of nitpicked at Calvin. Now, the Catholics didn't like him either because he was a heretic. And they wanted to kill him. Albeit, this is an interesting point. He was sentenced by the Roman Catholics, right, to be burnt. However, on April 7th, he escaped and the Catholics had to settle for burning him in effigy. The sentence on Servetus was this: to be burned alive in a slow fire until his body becomes ashes. For the present, the sentence is to be carried out in effigy and his books to be burnt. After his escape from Vienna, Servetus foolishly went to Geneva and showed up in the church on August 13th, a Sunday when Calvin was preaching, and was promptly arrested. After a trial in which Calvin played a part, Servetus was executed on October 27th, 1553. The sentence this time was this: we condemn thee, Michael Servetus, to be bound and led to the place of chapel, there to be fastened to a stake and burnt alive together with thy book, as well as the one written by thy hand as the printed one, even till thy body be reduced to ashes, and thus shalt thou finish thy days to furnish an example to others who might wish to commit the like. His last words were this: O Jesus, Son of the Eternal God, have pity on me. It is truly ironic that Servetus was burnt in effigy by the Catholics, but in actuality by the Protestants. What Rome couldn't do, Calvin's church state did. Sound like a place you want to live? Not to me. I don't want to live there. I mean, Servetus was an interesting guy because he hated Rome and he had some good quotes against him. He said this about the Pope: O vilest of all beasts, most brazen of harlots. He was a heretic, but I like that quote. That's a good one. To him, he said the Mass was a satanic. I said satanic. I haven't said that in a while. Satanic. Was a satanic monstrosity and an invention of demons. Well, I agree with that. I think the Mass was that for sure. Is that? He further equated the Pope with the Antichrist and the seven-headed dragon in Revelation. You know, so Servetus was a Unitarian. He was wrong. He was a heretic. Plain and simple. Now, some of the things they accused him of probably weren't true, but that's how Rome and some of the Protestants did things, okay? The point is, nobody's defending his Arianism or whatever he was into. We're not defending that. He's a heretic, but God didn't tell us to take the sword and chop heretics' heads off or burn them at the stake. What did he say? Preach the word. Be instant in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all long suffering of doctrine. He told us to preach to them.
Amen.
Tell them. In meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves. Right? That peradventure they might be what?
Saved,
right? That they might be brought from their deception, away from the devil, out of their deception, who the devil has in his clutches. But that's not the spirit here. Right? The fact that Calvin himself did not physically burn Servetus does not mean that he was not responsible. 7 years previously, Calvin wrote to Pharaoh in a letter, which he stated this. So this is important. He said, Servetus lately wrote to me, and coupled with his letter, a long volume of his delirious fancies, with the Thrasnic boast that I should see something astonishing and unheard of. He takes it upon him to come hither, if it be agreeable to me, but I am unwilling to pledge my word for his safety. For if he shall come, I shall never permit him to depart alive, provided my authority be of any avail. Calvin admitted in this letter that he was not going to let, if Servetus came, he was not going to let him leave alive. All this was done before Servetus ever came to Geneva. So Calvin was waiting for him to come there, and he was not going to let him leave alive. This is what a church state does. This is the danger of that. And when we get into America here, pretty soon, shortly here, in the next hour, what you'll understand and you'll find is some of these same things were starting to go on in New England. And then we come to Rhode Island for a reason. So, there's more that can be said. I'll read you this. The initial accusatory complaint did not claim Servetus was an anti-Trinitarian. However, during the trial, when Servetus served a legal brief that heresy did not deserve to be punished with death, Calvin countered by insinuating the death penalty was proper under Justinian Codex of 534 AD for anti-Trinitarianism. This implied thereby that this defunct law should be allowed by Geneva despite its own civil code's very different terms. The civil code of Geneva only provided expulsion and banishment for the only religious verbal crime, blasphemy. So Calvin used a Roman Catholic law to put Servetus to death. He didn't even use his own Geneva law that he codified. Do you understand that? He used that. So it shows you where his philosophy comes from, where the church state model came from, and that someone is going to die when that happens. All right? Calvin tried to defend himself in public and act like he didn't put Servetus to death. He said, I hope this sentence of death will at least be passed upon him, but I desire that the severity of the punishment may be mitigated. He didn't want him burned at the stake, he says. He will be led forth to the punishment tomorrow. We endeavored to alter the mode of his death, but in vain. Why we did not succeed, I defer this narration to you. Calvin was acting, like he didn't want that to happen, okay? But he did. But Calvin justified, the second way Calvin justified his way of putting him to death was he was a child of his age. So, hey, everybody justified Calvin. Hey, Calvin wasn't that bad of a guy. Everybody was burning people at the stake. So many of the reformers and their historians try to soften the blow of what Calvin did. I'm not going to read all of that, their excuses for it, because it really doesn't matter that much. But a lot of the historians, some of them are very honest. The verdict of the non-Calvinist historians is unanimous. The respected Lutheran historian John Mosheim says this. Judged in favor of Servetus, he did. The English historian Gibbon remarked, I am more deeply scandalized at the single execution of Servetus than at the hecatombs which have blazed in the auto de fes of Spain and Portugal. The zeal of Calvin seems to have been envenomed by personal malice and perhaps envy. And the Baptist historian William Jones, although acknowledging he was a Calvinist and had many doctrinal sentiments in common with Calvin, says this, I strenuously deprecate every attempt to palliate the enormity of Calvin's conduct. He said, I can't condone it. The Calvinist historian McNeil says this, when all is understood, admirers of Calvin must still look upon it with shame. Augustus Strong said this: "There can be no doubt that Calvin beforehand, at the time, and after the event, explicitly approved and defended the putting him to death and assumed the responsibility of the transaction." Another man said, "In our judgment, Calvin was guilty of sin." And he was. Philip Schaff says, tells of a Lutheran minister who visited Geneva and says this: "When I was in Geneva, I observed something great, which I shall remember and desire as long as I live, which was the weekly investigations into the conduct and even the smallest transgression of the citizens." Wait, so this Lutheran pastor admired the fact that they had home visits by the SS of Geneva. Now, how would you like that? That's not the government model that we are under. We have some tyranny that happens like that sometimes, but that's not our government model. That's not liberty. How about the historian Will Durant said this: "To regulate lay conduct, a system of domiciliary visits was established and questioned, and occupants on all phases of their lives." They investigated all phases of their lives in Geneva. Listen to this: "The allowable color and quantity of clothing and the number of dishes permissible at a meal were specified by law. Jewelry and lace were frowned upon. A woman was jailed for arranging her hair to an immoral height." Does anybody know what that height is? So she did a beehive. So after she did the beehive, she went to jail. She did not pass go. She did not collect $200.
She didn't get a fair trial.
She didn't get a fair trial. She and her beehive went to jail. Okay. Censorship of the press was taken over from Catholic and secular precedents. To speak disrespectfully of Calvin or the clergy was a crime. Fornication was to be published with exile or drowning. Adultery, blasphemy. Do you hear I said drowning? You heard that, right? Like, who thinks about drowning somebody? What a sicko. "Oh, I think I'll drown you." Yeah, that's a reasonable punishment by death. "I think I'll drown you." I mean, why not chop the guy's head off if you're going to be that merciless? I mean, seriously, you're going to drown them so they suffocate in the water? And you're telling... I'm sorry, this just gets me angry, because that's exactly what Zwingli did to those Baptists when he drowned them. What does the Bible say about that? "They will put you to death and think what? That they doeth God service." Oh, here's one. "Idolatry is punished with death. A child was beheaded for striking his parents." Has your little three-year-old ever went like, back and you say, "No, you don't do that"? Now, I'm sure it was a punch in the face probably or something like that. But the point is, first of all, that's none of Calvin's business. That's none of the state's business. They put that child to death for striking his parents. From the official records of the city, I'm almost done, for the official records of the city council, Stefan Zweig noted this: "There is hardly a day in the records of the settings of the town council in which we do not find the remark, 'Better consult Master Calvin about this.'" John Calvin was given a consultant's chair in every meeting of the city authorities, and when he was sick, the authorities would come to his house for sessions. Okay, now more can be said, but there were many children, by the way, that were put to death in Geneva for disobeying their parents. You say, but maybe it was really bad disobedience. Well, maybe it was. But still, do we see that in the New Testament? Do we see that in the New Testament, that we are to be governed of the new covenant? Do we see where God says that your children are to be put to death if they strike you, that we're to enforce that with the arm of the state? Is that there? No. No, it's not there. But that's what happened in Geneva. So the bottom line is, people died in Geneva. Okay? People died in Geneva under Calvin's rule and under a theocracy and under a church state. That's the model. The church controlling the state was the model in Geneva. A religious police state, basically. So when we come back, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to compare that with the religious liberty and the government that was founded upon religious liberty, the first government that was founded on liberty of conscience and religious liberty in Rhode Island, and the men that founded that and what they went through to get to that point, and the difference in government. So when we come back on the Baptist Battle for Liberty.